So this increasing resiliency, decreasing reactivity. And the way that they interweave in each other. And I think for a lot of us, we have a side that we're stronger with. Like a lot of us are really good at what I call digging in the dirt, working with our reactivity. Like untangling, attending, naming, resolving, whatever. Some of us are really, really strong in supporting the resiliency side. But they actually inter-support each other. So that's a theme you can be on the lookout for with this, what I'm calling a resiliency toolkit in the Dharma, is like, oh, how do those two sides support each other with each of these themes? Mean, we could say that increasing resiliency, decreasing reactivity is a modern day version of wise effort, right? Cultivating that which supports, transforming, releasing that which doesn't support. Opening quote, one I've been sharing and reflecting on for years. I first came across it at the time of Leonard Cohen's death, which was in the 72-hour period after our last election cycle. So there was a lot going on in this country at that time. It's a big transition. And Leonard Cohen, internationally known musician, rock star, also a poet, also deep Zen practitioner, passed away during that period. So it has some strong language, but I leave it in to keep his voice intact in the world. He said, "This world is full of conflicts and full of things that cannot be reconciled. But there are moments when we can transcend the dualistic system and reconcile and embrace the whole mess. And that's what I mean by hallelujah." So, hallelujah, of course, being his 1980s smash hit song. He said that regardless of what the impossibility of the situation is, there is a moment when you open your mouth and you throw open your arms and you embrace the thing and you say, "Hallelujah, blessed is the name." The only moment you can live here comfortably in these absolutely irreconcilable conflicts is in this moment when you embrace it all and you say, "Look, I don't understand a fucking thing at all. Hallelujah." It's the only moment we live here fully as human beings. I've had so many moments like that in these last weeks and months. It's just like something, the most ordinary thing that I think I know how it operates, I do not understand a thing about it in this moment. It's completely pivoted to needing some different orientation and some different response. It's like, I don't know. And that those moments over and over again of opening our mouths and opening our arms and connecting and saying, "I don't understand," and embrace it anyway. And I don't like it, and I don't embrace, and I don't embrace it and embrace it anyway. It's huge. This full humanness. Hallelujah might not be your word. You might want to translate it into a different word, but it's almost like there's a song in there in that, and the song is like the lullaby that reminds us to reconnect with our deeper understanding. And I can just hear it in the old song, Hallelujah. 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 It's like something singing to us inside. And while we're cocooned, we might have more time and space to hear it. Might have different words. So the list for supporting increased resiliency, decreased reactivity. Firstly, staying embodied and grounded. Second, remembering again and again our deeper intentions and values. Third, gratitude and the other heart practices. Fourth, taking refuge again and again. Including that essence awakeness itself. That each one of us as a human being with a mind and body is a conduit for. Fifth, staying connected with others. And sixth, offering service. And then lastly, dedicating the merit. So we'll move through these, we'll touch into these. Reflection on each. Some of them will have a little practice with them. But again, looking as you reflect and explore through this list, which of these qualities are most supportive for you right now, how you'd bring them together, what you'd add to the list. I could keep going with the list, but if a list gets too long, then nobody remembers anything on the list. So I always sort of cut myself off at 7. I aim for 5, it bleeds over to 7, and I call it good enough when I'm making up lists. So this one's no exception. So the importance of this body as a vehicle for ground, presence, awakeness, wholeness as we live in this life. It's huge. And instead of talking about the body, I thought maybe we could just do a couple of the mindfulness of the nervous system practices again. Because when we touch into a practice over and over again, it becomes natural. And then we can use it when things are more complicated than when we're just sitting here together. So maybe just for right now, the orienting and resource practice. These are both practices I do hundreds of times a day. And the orienting practice is the one that supports us to arrive more fully here in the room. Ida, here. So we just need eyes that work well enough, a neck that works well enough. And even though we've looked around the room we're in before, we'll do it again with fresh eyes. Fresh eyes to see clearly the space we're inhabiting. So we look to either side. We look behind us even though we know what's behind us, because on a nervous system level it's different than intellectual knowing. Really landing your eyes on different objects, connecting, labeling, not being vague about the looking. Landing our eyes on the exits so that the nervous system knows that there's an exit and where it is. So we look, as it said in the suttas, above and below and around and everywhere. I often smile when I do this practice, especially at the end when I land my eyes on a visual object that has pleasant feeling tone. My favorite color, favorite piece of art, favorite view. And just take a few breaths and I'll smile to myself, taking in that pleasantness. So these ways that we can continue inviting ourselves to arrive here, even in environments that are so familiar that it's easy to be vague, it's easy to not quite connect. whether it's our physical environment or our internal environment. It's like, oh, I know that story so well. I sort of labeled it and I sort of came back to the breath. Just like brings that real aliveness, freshness in the simple practice. So for me, every time I go into a new space, a new physical space, I do that practice. And so normally when I'm moving around in the world a lot, there's a lot of new spaces. But it's been very, very rich to do it at home, where it's the same space. And like, ah, oh, here, this space that I've been in 25 times already today, here, Ida. Kind of fun. So resourcing, grounding practice, and the nervous system. Basic principle behind this practice is that reactivity moves up energetically in the nervous system body. And if we bring attention down into the hands or the feet and the extremities, it reminds that reactive energy moving up that it doesn't have to keep spiking. And it reminds it from the inside, instead of telling ourselves to calm down and get it together, which doesn't really work so well, especially long term. So instead, we use the old wisdom, the ancient wisdom of the body, to support that increasing of resiliency from the inside. And so, you know, choose your feet or your hands. If your feet hurt, use your hands. If your hands hurt, use your feet. If they both hurt, choose somewhere that feels grounding that doesn't hurt. Okay. And you don't have to do this eyes closed. I do this practice every time I notice reactivity. I take a deeper breath, and on the exhale, I feel my feet. It's just a wholesome habit I have. It took time to develop that, but it works. You know, we can develop these habits. So feel the field of sensation that tells you that you have hands or feet for a moment. Maybe take a couple deeper breaths. And we just take a couple minutes here with the hands or the feet on an elemental level, right? This is all first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body teachings, including the elements, earth, air, fire, water, make up this body. So noticing whether the sensations feel heavy or light, earth. Hot, warm, cool, cold, fire. Checking out if the sensations have flow or cohesion, water. And then air, any tingling, vibrating, pulsing, or their absence. Okay. So that took less than 2 minutes. I'm looking to develop practices that take less than 2 minutes, that I can practice all the time. So indications of reactivity decreasing in the nervous system include warmth, heat, settling or heaviness, tingling, vibrating, pulsing, flow. Can't make it happen. We just keep showing up with the mindful attention that supports that unwinding. It does take repetition. So this staying embodied and grounded is, it's a verb. It's not like we get there and live happily ever after. We're in relationship with these bodies. So we keep coming back and supporting them as they are, with more reactivity and less reactivity in endless cycles. So, you know, I've been teaching these practices now for 15 years. can't tell you how important they are in a world that resiliency is hard to get a finger hold on and stay in relationship with. They aren't the best practices. They aren't the only practices. But please include your body in your practice right now and for the rest of your life. Whether it's daily outside, daily exercise, daily yoga, qigong, tai chi, walking. And then having practices that you can do in the moment that nobody knows you're doing for when the reactivity goes up, when you're feeling strong emotions, when the stress in the room starts to go through the roof, and nobody knows you're doing them. I call them stealth dharma. Really important. Doing practices like that aren't just for us. But by doing practices like that, we're supporting collective fields of resiliency through embodiment. So it's actually also part of offering service. So remembering intentions and deeper values, the second one. I know that for some people, intention is not your practice, and that's okay. But I think for all of us in these last weeks and months, there's been some sort of internal ongoing process of connecting with our deeper values. When the world as we know it starts to unravel and fall away, what do we really care about? Really, really care about. That's what I'm talking about. And I feel like when we nurture those inner explorations, and they might not be meditations, it might be writing or being in nature, or it just pops up when we're washing our hands at the sink. You know, it doesn't really matter. But when we nurture those reflections and explorations, then they're fueling those values to start to move more through the way that we think and the way that we speak and the way that we live. So instead of saying more about it, I actually just want to create a little space here for us to touch in again for the 1,000th time. What do we really care about? What really matters when the stuff that doesn't matter so much falls away? Yeah, for me, there's this whole process of touching in, taking that moment to really feel, and then expanding the attention awareness before the mind starts to create meaning or stories out of what I saw or felt. No, for me, that's that practice. And I noticed what came up as I touched in for the 1,000th time just now. What do I really care about? Happen to be the next two qualities on the list, you know, the heart and the refuge. These are things that matter to me when the things that I think are important but actually I could take or leave fall away. The heart, the refuge. So, heart practices. How many of you have some sort of formal or informal ongoing heart practice? Yeah, lots of folks. It's not for everybody, but at the right time, it's super supportive. Um, I found this quote from one of you who is in ongoing training with me, actually, somebody who's here. I'll leave it anonymous. But it's this relationship between gratitude as a heart quality and connecting in with a sense of deeper refuge. So this person said, "Recently, I have been using gratitude as a doorway to deepening awareness. Throughout the day, I notice that when I have done something kind or generous for myself or others, I pause and express gratitude, feeling gratitude for that act. There is often a feeling of openness, spaciousness, an unclogging of the mind, less self, more empty, more connected." It's actually that quote of somebody's experience is such a wonderful weave of the heart practices, taking refuge in awareness, offering service. So with the gratitude and the heart practice, so many of us have had long-term different cycles of these kind of practices. One thing I love about gratitude and familiar, which I'm going to highlight, is how accessible it is to actually developing connection with others, and they don't need to meditate, they don't need to be Dharma students, everybody can connect with a sense of gratitude. So when doing endless screen time becomes a little bit too much, maybe it's just texting each other a gratitude every day, you know, or for some people they journal it. For some people, they make art about it. For some people, their daily walks include it. You know, but for me, this balance of the way that we're neurologically hardwired to look for trouble for survival, I want to honor that, and I want to support it. You know, and at the same time, I want to be nurturing that balance of resiliency through qualities like gratitude, to actually do the same thing, to support the connectedness and survival. No. So your quality may be not gratitude. It may be metta, loving kindness. It may be compassion, or joy, or equanimity. But really being on the lookout, like which qualities support and how do we practice them formally and informally. So on that note, I was thinking about how many folks I'm talking to all over the US and Canada and certain places in Europe when it's allowed, who are taking daily walks. It's part of the practice, right? And then I was thinking about how in my early years of 2-month retreat, back when I was a young Dharma student doing 2-month retreats at Spirit Rock every year, I would actually say all of the heart wishes while I did my walking meditation. So instead of lifting, moving, placing with the feet, I would just say to myself or even sing to myself the metta phrases, the compassion, the sympathetic joy, and the equanimity, and it was my walking meditation practice. And then when I'd leave retreat, when I'd take my daily walks and I started noticing myself being lost in stories and not fully present, then I would just start with those same wishes while I was taking my walk. It was so rich for me. And I just remembered this actually today. So now when I go and take my walk, I'm going to start doing it again. It's like that, you know, we have these practices, they're really rich for us, and then time goes by, we forget, and then they like come back new, fresh. So I thought I would just share with you, and we can just take a moment and feel into the heart, my wishes for all of those qualities. And if some of those heart practices you don't have wishes, you could certainly use mine. And then I'll just leave a pause where you can say to yourself your own wishes. May I be protected and safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy and strong. May I live with ease. I care. I care about this pain. Through the caring, may the pain be eased. May this happiness and good fortune continue. May it increase. May it never wane. All things arise and pass away, and are not I or mine. May I trust in the unfolding. May I hold these joys and sorrows in equanimity and balance. Heart. So those wishes were moving through the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. The next quality or possibility of taking refuge. Often. So this poem's by William Stafford. It's called The Way It Is. There is a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt and die. And you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of that thread. Now, if I was going to describe my own practice in terms of refuge with one image or metaphor, it would be that poem. It's like, for me, internally, directly, there is an energy, just to use a word. There is something that I cannot describe except in metaphor that is so obvious and so tangible and yet so subtle. that it's really easily missed and people don't get it. And my practice with refuge is basically just staying as close as possible, as intimate as possible, until there isn't a subject and object with that thread, with that inner knowing that is beyond all the objects arising and passing away, that includes all the experience of our humanity arising and passing away. It holds it in this tremendous embrace. It's like one of the most powerful reflections of awakened awareness is warmth. It's caring. And so, like, when our hearts are really open, we tend to be a lot closer to that thread. And you may not use thread as the metaphor. You may have a different metaphor. Doesn't matter. You know, and for some of us, some of the time, it's pretty fleeting. And it's really just about kind of glimpsing something bigger than the contracted self-life show. And we just sort of rest back into it for a moment. And then other times there's a real ongoing sense of continuity with that deeper understanding, that wiser view. And I'll use the analogy of the glasses. And the glasses just fill with all kinds of different reactivity, you know, anger, fear, wanting, confusion. They just fill up. You see the whole world through those lenses. Then they just clear out. And there is this clarity and brightness and intimacy. So however it is that we connect with a deeper refuge, whether it's through the three traditional refuges, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, awake, truth, community, whether it's an image of a place or that visceral sense that we have with a few people in our lives where it's like all of a sudden you just feel like you're home when you're with them. It doesn't really matter what the muse is, because it's just a muse. It's just connecting us with that deeper sense of refuge that's totally beyond words and totally beyond muses. So here's one of the ways that this is described by Ajahn Sumedho, very famous quote, and he's using the word awareness to point to this, just a very simple word. But he's talking about something way, way more mature in terms of spiritual access than just your garden variety mindful awareness, which is also very, very helpful and which helps us connect with a deeper sense of knowing. So he says, awareness is your refuge. Awareness of the changingness of feelings, of attitudes, of moods, of material change and emotional change. Stay with that because it's a refuge that is indestructible. It is not something that changes. It is a refuge you can trust in. This refuge is not something that you create. It's not a creation. It's not an ideal. It's very practical and very simple, but easily overlooked or not noticed. When you're mindful, you're beginning to notice. It's like this. It's just like this. And that suchness, it's like it goes back to the Leonard Cohen quote of that full embrace. It's like, oh, something's happening. It's like this. And in the embrace of that caring, open awareness, everything is then included. Ooh, I have another poem on that in the pile. It's actually written by one of the women who attends my annual Berkeley Women's Weekends. So she wrote this after the, I think, the last Women's Weekend I held last January. It's called To Be Held in Expanse. The open field upon the crest of fall leaves in rebirth. Evergreen stability. You, a passing creature, an exchange of breath, of blessings. To be held in expanse is to know your place and feel boundless. To be held in expanse is to root down and out. To be held in expanse is to include everything and let everything include you. It's like, again, so many themes here. The body, the awareness, the heart, the connection. Next one on the list, staying connected with others. Oh, so we know we can't walk the spiritual path alone. And particularly those of us with certain backgrounds have a deep understanding of the way that isolation erodes our inner resiliency. No. For some of us with some backgrounds, it's very dangerous, isolation. But we know that fundamentally, as a human being, we need the connection for survival. It's actually one of the things that we need. Maybe not like the most important thing we need for survival, but we do need it. It's important. And so, you know, this piece in these times of the kind of the balance and the creativity and the improv of staying connected with ourselves, staying connected with nature, staying connected with others, is huge. Now, especially when a lot of our connection right now is happening on screens and we just get exhausted, right? So there's like more and more research coming out about the exhaustions of Zoom. And everything from one of the pieces of research I think came out of Stanford recently that particularly interested me was the one where basically our mind body has a disconnect on a screen because we have enough input to get the facial and the body language, which is so connective and resiliency producing, but we're not actually in the same room. And so that disconnect between the information input and the somatic can start to actually exhaust us over time. Because it's like, it feels like one thing, but it's not. It feels like one thing, but it's not. Those kind of discrepancies can be exhausting. I feel like if we can bring our mindfulness and heart practice to these discrepancies, we can kind of move it out of the double bind a little bit. Just acknowledge, oh yeah, I feel really connected. Like I'm making eye contact. No, it's not the same as in the same room. And I feel connected. You know, and this back and forth and back and forth, so that there's a wholeness of acknowledging what's true, the connection, and then not the same connection. I feel like it'd be really helpful. I'm starting to work with it myself a lot. Because really, I really haven't seen anybody in person, you know? this whole thing about our eyes on the screens. Somebody a couple weeks ago sent me these wonderful eye exercises to support the eyes to be able to have the connection on screens with some more resiliency. I thought I'd share a couple of those just for fun, just in case you might need them. one of them, you can just do it while we're hanging out here if you want. One of them is just making figure eights with the eyes. Again, it just gets more of that range of motion going because we tend to fixate on a screen and the eyes get dry and they get tight. You can try that. No. Another one is sort of a pendulation practice is how I'm thinking of it. of moving back and forth between a fixed gaze and a soft gaze. So we can practice it right now, not looking at the screen, and then practice with it later looking at the screen and see if it helps you. Okay. So not looking at the screen, we're going to look at something in the room, just an object in the room. And I want you to look at it like really hard, like a fixed gaze, like focus, concentrate, you know, really look at it. And feel your eyes as you do that, around your eyes. And then we'll pendulate, we'll move to a different way, and you can close your eyes for a second if you need to in between, but we're just going to soften around the eyes, all the muscles. It's like, let the gaze draw back from the physical object and just rest in the space. Really soft gaze, not looking at anything in particular. And then when the object comes back in focus in your gaze, letting your gaze with that physical object remain soft. Simple practices. So it's like, yeah, just really having some awareness. And for me, it's like over time awareness of when is a simple text enough connection and I don't actually need to tell the story of the world situation with somebody again in this moment. It's a little too much. But like just to send those hearts, those emojis, like, oh, yeah, that's it. You know, when are we on screen? When are we on the phone? When is our deepest sense of connection going to be with nature? When do we need to be wrapped up in a blanket and giving ourselves a hug? You know, all these levels of connection, so important. And I don't think there's a single answer. You know, it's this deep listening ongoing. I have to do it all the time. It's like I'll get done with a day of sessions with students and I just can't talk to anybody else, but I just need to connect with somebody else. And so like learning how to actually make those connections, not just black or white, can't take any more verbal or screen time, so I'm not going to connect. It's like, no, there's other ways to do it. Being really, really creative. These are like the dances of our times. So, where are we? Staying embodied, deeper intentions, heart practices, refuge, staying connected, offering service. So we are all well aware that the safety nets of this country, anyway, of the United States of America, are stretched totally thin. They're breaking. It's breaking down. And it was breaking down before these times. And we all know it. And I feel a lot of grief about that. Because I really see it could be otherwise. And yet, as a single individual, I cannot make it otherwise. So for me, part of the offering service is actually acknowledging grief and loss and a sense of helplessness. Because if I leave that out, then I tend to move into dynamics of heroics or codependence or, you know, these near misses of genuinely mature service being offered. I just felt important to acknowledge that as part of my own path. In case it's true for some of you. But I also feel really strongly that like every single one of us has gifts and skills and influence to offer in this world on every single level. And then if we're not playing small, so if we're not drowning in, heroics or codependence, and we're just saying, you know, I could call a neighbor before I go to the grocery store. Or we're saying, you know, I heard somebody might be sick and I'm not sure what's going on. Why don't I drop them a line or talk to somebody else who is in contact with them and just make sure I'm keeping my heart really close to them right now. Or, you know, that nonprofit, I really care about it. I wonder if there's something I can do to help right now. Or somebody else who I know who might be able to do something to help that I can't do to help. Because influence is everything. Whenever I feel helpless in the face of my own skills, I look around and I go, who do I have connection with who has different skills and influence than me? And then it becomes us. It moves from that feeling of like, God, it's never going to be enough, to like, hey, we got this. You know, the safety net is going to come from us. It is coming from us right now. I mean, thank you for being part of that net. Now, I mean, I know for myself, you know, being a Dharma teacher and like all the work completely disappeared and how do we get this online and how am I going to survive? I don't feel alone. I feel connected. That doesn't mean I don't feel scared sometimes. It doesn't mean we don't all feel scared sometimes. We are feeling scared sometimes. And then we feel connected. And we're offering this service on every level. You know, starting with our prayers, our blessings, you know, our heart practice. And then moving into, you know, connecting and checking in emotionally. And then moving into practical levels of support. You know, how many of us have gone and done something or bought something for somebody who couldn't in the last 2 months? Just show of hands. You know? Or ask somebody and they said no, but you asked them, you know? It's not too late. Not too late. One of the things that people have been sharing with me that feels really important to keep passing on, because it's totally inspired me, is the folks right now who are out of work because their jobs are not safe to do right now, who are part of our personal support teams. You know, our hairdressers, our body workers, people who perhaps take care of our land, you know, our gardeners, and on and on and on. And really, I'm thinking about those folks who are not able to work right now, sending our blessings to them, but also considering supporting them financially, or even just calling and checking in so that they know that we still remember them and they know that we care. There's a growing group of people who are starting to offer what I think of as donations to the support team people who are not able to work in their lives right now, and they're offering the donation anyway, even though they're not receiving the service. You know, that is a huge potential power safety net in this country right now for where things are falling through the cracks, I feel like. You know, and again, in the spirit of Donna, it may not be about the amount or even the actual resource that we're offering. It's just the fact that we're offering is really, really important. And now I'm looking around the screen and I'm seeing some of you guys who I know actually fall into this category, that you're unable to work. You know, we care about you. So the Buddha talked about three joys associated with offering service or generosity or dana. I've been practicing with this for years. It brings me so much joy to practice with it. He said we feel joy when we think about offering service or generosity. When it first comes to our mind, even if we don't do anything, we still feel joy. And then when we offer it, thought, word, or deed, we feel joy. Just so different than like, I don't know if I can really offer that. I'm not sure it was totally enough. Maybe it was too much. That's not what he's talking about. And then afterwards, when we reflect back on it, we feel joy because it feels right. That kind of practice clears the lenses of reactivity and allows our natural empathetic resiliency to shine forth. And then it's not about the person that we did something for, whether it's us or another. It's actually about the spirit of it and the joy of it. So one of my favorite quotes on this comes from the African-American mystic and activist Howard Thurman, who puts it like this. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. I have such a passion for manifesting aliveness right now. Okay, we're moving on to the last one, dedicating the merit. So dedication of merit is something that we do at the end of a sitting group or a retreat. You know, dedicating the blessings, the quality of blessing of our practice in all directions to all beings. Understanding that there actually are no limits of the human mind. It's boundless. So our blessings can flow boundless. But a lot of us don't have a personal practice of dedication of merit. And so this came up for me quite a number of years ago in response to some despair that I was feeling about the state of the world. And just feeling like even though literally my entire life is offering service practically from the moment I get up to the moment I go to bed, there were too many nights when I was still going to bed feeling like I hadn't done enough. That I just couldn't meet the need and the despair and the kind of collapse that comes with that. I know I'm not alone. I'm just sharing my own story of it. Many of us feel this at times. And so at that point, I started really developing the practice of dedicating the merit for that part of my being that just felt like it could never be enough. It's like, hey, I'm going to bookmark it. I'm going to punctuate my day with this last blessing and say, this is enough. And be a part of that bigger prayer field is how the world culture would call it, because prayer happens in every spiritual and religious tradition. And so in many indigenous cultures worldwide, there's this deep understanding that the world's actually held up by our blessings and our prayers energetically. Energetically. And then we act out of that sense of blessing and shared field. So this has been a huge part of my practice this last month. When I was feeling overwhelmed and despair again one day of just like what we're actually dealing with. And it was really interesting. For me, I have a very, very sensitive energetic body. So I feel things that are bigger than me all the time. So it's a lot to hold this field. There's a huge amount of reactivity in our global field right now, more than I've experienced in my lifetime. And so it was just feeling too much. And in the very moment that it felt like too much, something shifted. And what came forward was this sense of like, oh my gosh, it's not just that I'm in a more reactive field than I've ever been in. I'm in a bigger, more powerful prayer field than I've ever been in my whole life. And all of a sudden, I just started hearing it, not words, like a murmur in every language, in every spiritual tradition and religion, just this murmur of the prayers and how powerful they are right now, like we've never experienced globally. And I just rested back and I was like, oh. And I just rested back and let myself be held. And I could feel that prayer field just filling me up the same way the heart practices fill us up. You know, I could just feel it filling it up, and I could feel the exact moment where I didn't need to rest in it anymore and be held, but like my prayer started coming out and becoming a part of it. You know, it's like we drain, we refill, we give back. We drain, we refill, we give back. And this merit field, this blessing field, is a huge resource that we can be held in and that we can offer to all the time, not just at a retreat. Not even just at the end of the day, all the time. Dedicating the merit. So this quote is from the Talmud. Love this life. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. The day is short. The task is great. The wages are paltry. And the matter is pressing. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. So, closing quote by Joanna Macy. Now, harvesting these games, we are ready to return. The third movement begins. Having gained distance in the sophistication of perception, we can turn and recognize who we have been all along. Now it can dawn on us, we are our world knowing itself. We can relinquish our separateness. We can come home again and participate in our world in a richer, more responsible, and more poignantly beautiful way than ever before.